Hi, I'm your friend Claude.
And I am just Jamie.
And today, on the Nerd Bomber podcast, we're going to do something a little different. We are going to debut a segment called The Essential Era. And it is all about a time in our lives that is important to one or both of us for various reasons. In this case, I think I'll be taking the lead. But yeah, going forward, I think we will always just kind of highlight a single year out of our lives and explain why it was essential to us. So with that said, today's debut episode kicks off with the year 1988. The first reason I picked this year is because this is the year we turned 6 years old, and it seems to be the age where most of our earliest memories start. In my research for this episode, I came across a blurb from Psychology Today, and according to them, in their research with adults, it suggests that people can remember early childhood memories back only to about age 6 on average. Researchers agree that few experiences before age 6 become lifelong memories, and it's attributed to the fact that between the ages of 6 and 8, it marks a transition period from moving past early life memories to the memories that you'll keep kind of with you for the rest of your life. And they call that childhood amnesia.
That is an ominous name for that.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense.
Anecdotally, I guess it checks out. I have a few memories from being, maybe 4 and 5, not really much before that, maybe a few images, not really full-fledged memories. So I guess that checks out for the most part.
Yeah, I thought it was a little late, but it backed up my choice, so I went with it. But yeah, I have a few memories. I have one solid memory from age 2.
Wow.
But it's just very isolated. It's not anything that can be like, well, I have memories from this point forward.
Right.
But yeah, so I don't know. I guess that's an average. But also, according to WebMD, a.k.a. youprobablyhavecancer.com, some of the human milestones that occur at age 6 include starting to see that some words have more than one meaning, therefore helping you understand jokes and puns and allowing you to start verbally expressing a sense of humor, which is the perfect age for some of my picks for that to happen. apparently, it's also the age when children should begin to understand the concept of numbers, know day from night and left from right, and be able to tell time. So it seems that age 6 is basically when we start becoming viable humans.
Right, right. Yeah, a lot of those pieces of knowledge are being pushed to earlier and earlier ages. So
right.
It's interesting to hear the science say, like, that's when your brain is really capable of handling it.
That's true.
And from another, sort of not as scientific field, they're pushing for these things to happen earlier and earlier. And I know it because I work in the field of young children. And
right.
Some of the things that we're trying to teach them and get them to understand are pretty complex.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's this is the our generation source.
I guess so.
Maybe they weren't as sticklery. So I guess personally, some of the reasons I picked 1988 are that is when I started first grade, which also happened to be my first experience with the concept of school having the ability to be a negative thing. I had my first mean teacher that year. And I started to have some difficulty with certain projects and assignments, whereas like the year before in kindergarten, it was kind of just we use macaroni and candy and we take naps.
again, it's an illustration of the difference between now and then, because the things that we were doing in kindergarten, kids are doing now in like a 3-year-old preschool classroom.
Yeah.
Naps and you can break the crackers on the line, and that's a pretty good achievement.
I remember specifically walking like to learn cursive, we would make the letter out of tape on the floor and then walk along it and say, A says ah as we walked.
Wow.
But yeah. It was also the year I developed my first official crush when our mutual friend Sarah came over to my desk to ask me for a hot pink crayon. And I did not have it.
Oh, well, that's a disappointment.
Yep. And I spent the next decade plus trying to give it to her. The crayon.
And my mother babysat Sarah from when we were really young children. She's actually the person I've known the longest that's not family. it's interesting that story pops up. You had her
as a captive audience the whole time. How many crayons did you give her?
I can tell a few stories.
Nice. Pop culturally, it's quite a list. The first aspect of pop culture that kind of sticks out for me in 1988 is baseball.
Like the natural beauty of the ocean's tide, the dawn of the 1988 baseball season brought about its own picturesque setting. After all, what could be prettier to a baseball fan than the sight of players reporting for spring training? Indeed, these are images and sounds that conjure up a wondrous feeling. The team with the best record in baseball walked away a loser. Perhaps the story of 1988 can be thought of as a fairy tale. But a fairy tale that came true.
The Mets World Series victory 2 years before this was my actual first baseball memory, but 88 was the year that I actually became interested in baseball, like for myself. Probably due to two things. One of them being my friendship with another of our mutual friends named Zach, who we've spoken about previously.
Yep.
He is the one who introduced me to baseball cards.
ESPN presents Major League Baseball Magazine. This week's cover story, you used to flip them, you used to trade them. Now you pay the big bucks for them. Baseball cards and memorabilia.
It's turning from a hobby into a business.
And probably solely responsible for me being a Mets fan too. And the second thing was, we went on our first family trip that wasn't a move. And it was to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and they both happened in 88.
Wow. Yeah, I was, when you said you wanted to do this show about 1988, I was not convinced. You know, I was kind of like, what the hell is so important about 1988? We were six. But when I started looking at the pop culture of the year, it was one thing after another, so I was surprised.
Yeah.
There was no really big life events from 1988. Not that I connect with that certain year. Around there sometime, my parents did get a new house. Mm. And I was really young. I mean, it was a new house in the same place because we did live in a single wide trailer and upgraded.
Okay.
So I remember, I don't know if I remember this or if I've constructed this memory based on knowing that it happened. Mm. But I guess we were standing there watching this happen. Either they were taking the old house out or putting the new house in. And I looked up at my mom and said, "Mommy, getting a new house?" "Yep, buddy, we are." "Oh, we get a new house? We get a new mommy?" And I start crying about it, I guess. And again, I don't know if I really remember this or if I've just made this because I've been told that it happened.
Right.
But I don't know for sure that was 88. It was right around there.
Right. Yeah, so the next thing on my list for why 1988 is important to me is the CBS Saturday morning lineup from the fall of 1988.
On CBS, it's Ernest!
Ernest on CBS? Go figure.
Superman!
Hi, I'm Raggedy Ann. And I'm Raggedy Andy.
Whoa! Garfield and Friends!
Hope the Academy Award people are watching.
Flip! Starting September 17th!
Gonna love the feeling
when Saturday rocks! On CBS!
Why shouldn't it be cartoons?
Exactly. It is, it's the first, I guess, time I became kind of enough aware of making a point to tune into specific cartoons. Right. Before that, you could just sit me down in front of whatever. And this lineup in particular for this year is interesting. It's got a wide variety of pretty unique stuff, full of short-lived programming. But, it remains my all-time favorite period for Saturday morning cartoons. And if you'll indulge me, I'm going to take us through a breakdown of the lineup.
You go, I'll follow.
Starting at 8 a.m., we had The Adventures of Raggedy Ann and Andy. And it was the debut year for this cartoon, which will also be a recurring theme. Apparently, 1988 was kind of a year of experimentation.
And this was all CBS specifically?
This particular lineup is all CBS. All
right, okay. Yep,
this is what you would have seen on that channel from 8 in the morning to, I believe, 12:30. Gotcha.
So I don't mean to derail you, but at your house, did you get Channel 12, the best?
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the CBS station.
Yep.
From the local, the nearest medium-sized city,
yeah.
Binghamton, New York. And for us, too, Channel 12 definitely came in twice as well as anything else.
Yeah.
So if you're going to watch something on NBC or ABC or Fox,
right.
You had to really be committed to it because it wasn't going to be as clear.
Yeah, I believe NBC was always the worst reception-wise, and then...
Fox was the worst for us.
Probably ABC, then CBS.
Yep.
Yeah, for whatever reason.
Right. Sorry, continue on.
No, that's actually a really good point. I wonder if that's why I just happened to default, watch it, and then it just became that I liked what I saw.
Right. Why would you struggle with the other channels?
Yeah.
Snowy and Fuzzy and 12, which was CBS.
Yeah.
WBNG.
Yep.
Was clear as a bell.
True. The Raggedy Ann and Andy show was produced by CBS in celebration of their 70th anniversary. And in many ways, this cartoon is the original Toy Story. It's all about toys that came to life when no humans were in their owner Marcella's bedroom. And they would have adventures in a parallel dimension to help save others from an evil sorcerer named Cracklin. I mean, I'm 6.
I know of it, and I know I watched it, but I don't have any memory of watching it.
Yeah. Well, it was also not just Saturday morning when I caught it. They would show it on random times of the day, too. So any time that, I was stuck inside and it's like 2 in the afternoon, oh, there's a cartoon, it became that, too.
Right, right.
Immediately after, at 8:30, was the debut of the Ruby Spears version of Superman. I believe I've mentioned this before on the show.
Probably.
But I will never turn down an opportunity to sing the praises of this one season only cartoon. It is, without a doubt, my favorite animated version of Superman. And it was also produced for an anniversary. This happened to be the year of Superman's 50th anniversary. To this day, it's the only Superman cartoon to ever use the iconic John Williams theme from the Christopher Reeve films.
Oh, nice.
It's also, it was the most comic faithful in terms of design. It had well-known comic book writer Marv Wolfman as the head story editor, and legendary artist Gil Kane did all the character designs. And it's worth noting that we recently compiled our own list of all-time comic book artists, and Gil Kane was my number 17 pick.
And he was also in my honorable mentions, but I didn't go all the way to 17, so...
That's true. Yeah, I went to
probably,
20.
If I went to 20, he probably would have made it.
Nice. Following that, at 9, we had a solid hour of the Muppet Babies.
Muppet Babies!
Come on, everybody!
Ah, this doesn't look too good for me, does it?
Incredible, isn't it?
Wow, what is it?
I mean, we've talked about this amazing show on more than one occasion in past episodes.
Right.
So anyone who's heard that knows how great having a full hour of it would make a Saturday morning.
Of course.
After that, at 10, we had Pee-wee's Playhouse. And I'm not sure how, I'm sure we've mentioned it, but I mean, it was just an excellent, innovative, and wacky show that was originally conceived as like a parody of like 50s and 60s kids shows.
Right.
Like Howdy Doody or Captain Kangaroo or the Mickey Mouse Club. But I think it ended up being able to stand kind of among those shows in its own right.
This did not debut in 88.
No.
It was part of the lineup, though.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
Yep. After that was a debut, however, and what a debut it was. 10:30 saw the debut of Garfield and Friends.
Yes, yes. It's on the list. It's on my list.
Of course.
Saturday Ross!
Oh, yeah!
On CBS.
Stay tuned for Pee-wee's Playhouse, followed by
Garfield and Friends.
Based on the insanely popular comic strip, this show would go on to run for 7 seasons until CBS decided to start phasing out cartoons and threatened threatened to cut the budget for Garfield and Friends, despite the show still having very strong ratings. Everything about this show was very well done, I thought. The theme song is incredibly catchy and memorable. The animation is beautiful and consistent, perfectly capturing and expanding on the look of the comic strip. And the format of the show was really unique, too. It was broken up into several segments, and I think that made it feel much longer than it was.
Right, right. Because I feel like there was usually like a main line Garfield story, U.S. Acre story, and then a short.
Yeah, apparently there was sometimes 2 shorts.
Oh, yeah.
But it was actually, I guess the main format was a Garfield story, a U.S. Acre story, a second Garfield story, and then one of the quickies, they called them.
Okay, quickies, right, yeah. Right.
And, I mean, that's what they were. They were shorts, and they basically featured kind of a mixed bag of either Garfield or the U.S. Acres characters, or sometimes even Binky the Clown gag, which are always hilarious. And much like the comic book artist list, we also recently put together a list of top Saturday morning cartoons. And Garfield and Friends is my personal number one pick. And it all began here in 1988.
Yeah, it was on my list too. I don't recall exactly where it fell. We should have had everything copied and pasted and ready to go from our archivist, right, who's keeping track of these lists for us. No, it's a great show. I love Garfield and Friends. Still do. Yeah. There's a lot of jokes from that show that are still in my head. There was an episode where Roy. Roy the Rooster was trying to outsmart Orson, and Orson opened a little like snack shack.
Right.
So he orders an elephant foot sandwich with mustard, and somehow Roy had an elephant, came upon an elephant, and says, "No, we have plenty of elephant. We just ran out of mustard." Because if they couldn't fill his order, then he would get it for free. Yeah, a ton of good jokes. You know, Garfield got away with stuff that he couldn't get away with now. You know, whoever invented fill in the blank deserves to be drug out into the street and shot. Yep. I mean, that was a joke that they came back to a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. That was like one of the welcome back to the episode jokes or whatever.
Yeah, it was a fantastic show.
Yeah. I mean, it almost single-handedly vindicates choosing this Saturday morning lineup all on its own because it's that good.
Very nearly.
Following Garfield, however, was another debut that I've also talked about a lot in life. I think it's been mentioned in the show before. But at 11 a.m., it was the debut of Hey Vern, It's Ernest.
Hey Vern, today's your lucky day. We knew you wouldn't want to oversleep, Vern. We only do it once a week, Vern. Me and all the other guys, Vern. We even brought the pies, Vern.
That's fantastic. Pee-wee and Ernest.
Yeah, the same lineup.
How great is that?
Just an hour apart. Based on Jim Varney's wacky Ernest character, who at this point had only been in one movie. Ernest Goes to Camp the year before.
Right.
So Ernest was mostly still known as an advertising character, having done local commercials in the South since 1980.
Yeah, very regional. It's
like Kentucky and surrounding areas.
Surprising what happened.
The show itself was kind of a kid's variety show made up of like a series of sketches featuring a range of crazy characters, including several also played by Varney. But all the sketches in a given episode revolved around that certain episode's central theme, like space or movies or magic. And I always thought the humor was so different from most of what was on TV then or even now. It felt like experimental and uniquely zany on the level, and the level of commitment by everyone involved helped to sell the whole concept. Even though it only lasted this one season.
We could probably thank Pee-wee's Playhouse for making it possible for a show like that to even get made.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, it's an experimental sketch show made for kids.
Right.
So, yeah, it was pretty innovative.
Despite the fact that it was only on this one season, I have remembered it fondly for the last 30 years, and it turns out it also helped earn Jim Varney an Emmy for Outstanding Performer in a Children's Series. And probably helped ensure that the character would go on to the string of low-budget but high-profit feature films.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic that he won an Emmy for Ernest.
Yep.
I did not know that, and it's welcome news.
Absolutely.
In a dark world.
Yep. I was surprised to learn that, too. Yeah, pretty heartwarming. So at 11:30, originally, when the fall of 88 happened, 11:30 was given to a show called Flip. and I hadn't had any memory of that show. It turns out it was basically a kid's version of Entertainment Tonight. I looked it up, and it looks cool. It's got a very an 80s, just screams 80s, the look of it.
Of course.
It seems fun, but apparently nobody else really enjoyed it either, because a couple of weeks into its run, they replaced it with what I do remember, and that is reruns from the year before of the cartoon adaptation of the movie Teen Wolf.
Wow. All right. Yeah. I don't have a memory of that one.
No, I remember watching that. I was certainly happier when that happened, of course.
Yeah.
I always loved the movie, and I guess the cartoon by association.
Right.
The cartoon was fun and entertaining in its own right. But it's also notable for being ahead of its time by presenting social struggles and civil rights issues for people who are quote unquote different or social outcasts, using the werewolf angle for that.
Right.
So.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
X-Men did it with mutants.
Right. It's always cool when you can sneak in kind of more sophisticated messages and things in kids' shows.
Right.
After that, at noon, we had Mighty Mouse, The New Adventures. Now, that's a show I thought only lasted for 1 year. I think it was two. And I had tried to find it for years, and nobody knew what I was talking about, or they thought I was talking about, the classic Mighty Mouse.
Right.
This was, a different, new, more humorous version of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, it continues the trend of being a show that focuses on creativity and kind of wacky, zany approach to humor. It was animated by John Kricfalusi, who went on to create and produce Ren and Stimpy.
Oh, wow.
It also launched the careers of a ton of people in the industry who would end up writing, producing, and directing on shows like The Simpsons, Batman the Animated Series, Animaniacs, Powerpuff Girls, and as well as movies like Wreck-It Ralph and Zootopia, among others.
See, I was going to say something about that when you were talking about Garfield, actually.
Wow.
Sort of the early 90s cartoon boom of comedy shows and sketch shows, Animaniacs, Tiny Toons,
right.
Sort of the Warner Brothers boom, but Disney also had a bunch of stuff come out. And I can't help but wonder if a show like what you're describing, but also, of course, Garfield, actually deserves more credit for inspiring that trend. Because Garfield was doing, several segments of show.
Right.
It was a sketch show
done
in animation form, which is what, Animaniacs would later perfect.
That's true. That's a great point. I didn't consider that. But I would certainly draw an arrow that points right back to those shows.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to finish off the Saturday morning lineup, we had at 12:30 a show called CBS Story Break. And it's another one of my favorites. It's like a hybrid. It's mainly a cartoon, but it's also has a live-action host.
Okay.
It was a unique show that it was kind of like Reading Rainbow on steroids, basically.
The title sounds very familiar, because once you get later in the morning, I start to lose familiarity with what you're talking about.
But you probably had to go outside and do things.
Right, yeah, go do something.
Right.
But this sounds familiar.
It was, Reading Rainbow showed you, still pictures while a narrator read a book. But this,
a narrator.
Yeah. Well, sometimes they had different narrators.
Okay, that's true.
This one took kind of the approach of using a popular children's book, but it actually made a full-length cartoon adaptation out of it. In the live action, during its original run, this 1988 ended up being the last year of the original run. It was hosted by the original Captain Kangaroo, Bob Keeshan.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And later, they brought it back in 93, it was just reshowing the episodes, but with new host segments, and those were hosted by Malcolm Jamal Warner from The Cosby Show.
Okay.
And this, it didn't win, but this was also Emmy nominated for Outstanding Animated Program. It was the first in-house CBS animation done since the original Mighty Mouse era, when they did Terry Toons in the 40s and 50s. So, That was my Saturday for quite a while.
So I'm looking at the graphics for CBS Story Break, and they are very familiar. So I was definitely watching CBS Story Break. So I just wonder what I was tuning away from CBS, missing some of the other things you're describing.
Right.
In the morning. And I don't know. I have two other cartoons that debuted in 1988 that you didn't mention that I want to mention.
Sure.
I don't know what time of day these ran, but I wonder if these had something to do with the fact that you know, I missed some of the things that you're describing. Would I have turned the channel because I wanted to watch this and come back to it? I don't know.
Right.
Anyway, the two that I found that debuted in 1988, which I know we both have familiarity with, are The New Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
Yep. And Fantastic Max.
Oh, yeah.
Which I know I've mentioned in the past.
I can't believe I forgot it. See, that wasn't part of... I mean, we basically had the same channels when it came to local channels.
Right, yep.
I remember that being... almost pre the normal Saturday morning lineup, like 6, 7 a.m. cartoons.
It might have been. I mean, yeah. I don't know for sure.
Like that and Super Ted were back to back.
Oh, all right, yeah.
So, yeah. So that was definitely 88 because I remember talking about it in first grade. I became friends with a kid named Wayne Wheeler because of that, because of Super Ted.
He was into Super Ted?
He was the only one I talked to who knew, like, I was drawing a picture of Super Ted's friend Spotty. And he goes, oh, is that Spotty?
We were not.
You know what that is?
You and I were not good enough friends at that point because I was watching Super Ted.
No, we had a year to go.
All right. Yep.
When we hit 89, that's going to be our big Pandora's box opening.
All right, okay. But yeah, those are the two that I had seen that you didn't mention. Everything else that I sort of jotted down, you covered in full.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, that's another big one.
I do want to throw out there, because you mentioned a sports memory in baseball.
Right.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I hadn't thought about it, but 1988 is also the first time I remember being aware, not so much aware that football was a thing, but being aware of a result, having a rooting interest. And that year, Washington beat the Denver Broncos. And I didn't watch football throughout the year. I was not like a week-to-week fan at 6 years old.
Right.
But I do remember watching the Super Bowl and wanting the Broncos to win.
Hmm.
I must have liked the blue and orange. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I remember being disappointed that they lost. So it's funny that you mentioned the sports thing because I wouldn't have thought of that. But it is the first football game that I remember being aware of a result.
Awesome. Would anybody in your house have been rooting for Denver? And you kind of latched onto that?
No, not specifically. No. I mean, you know, there's an AFC, NFC thing going on. With, you know, my household team was the Bills.
Yeah.
So I would be a long-suffering football fan. So they were in the AFC, so maybe we were rooting for the AFC team by default. I have no idea. I've never liked Washington. I never cared for their yellow and maroon color scheme. So I think at 6 years old, I don't know what else you'd go by other than what team looks cooler to you.
Yeah.
So I thought they must have looked pretty lame, so I rooted for the other team. <That's> It was to my chagrin.
That's pretty cool. I'm going to move on to movies of 1988 because if there's anything I did... almost as much as watch cartoons, it was watch movies.
There be a lot of them.
Yeah. I think I decided to cap myself here. As I was looking through the year, I'm like, oh yeah, that one and that one. I'm like, you know what? I've got enough.
Yep.
So the first one I'm going to lead off with is a kind of a doozy, and that would be Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I watched this movie a million times as a kid. Just constantly. And I was actually watching it on Betamax tape before even anybody had a VHS in my world. I remember particularly memorizing lyrics to any songs that were in the movie. And I even, the following year, we were given journals and I had like journal assignments randomly in second grade.
Like
and
the composition notebooks?
Yeah, the marble one. Yep, exactly. And I even wrote out the lyrics for the song that Eddie sings at the end. I can't remember what it's called. But basically kind of to distract the villains and save Roger. And
I would tell made-up stories in my journal. I would lie.
I think I just looking for an excuse to write the thing because it was in my head.
We went to a theme park and we did this and that. And
oh, you went that deep?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I did. I don't know how often, but I remember that one.
Right. But, yeah, I just... The interplay between the live actors and the cartoons always just blew my friggin' mind. And I have to admit, even though I was six, it's still embarrassing that I believed that it was actually possible on some level to interact with a cartoon.
Yeah, I had some interesting sort of, I don't know if it's a conspiracy theory, like a young version, little kid version of a conspiracy theory. Like, I thought for sure that the Thundercats, which does not quite fit into the 88 theme, the show was still on in 88.
Yeah.
I thought that it was like real people who sort of like put on a cartoon suit. And so, you know, when you zip it up, it looks like you look like a cartoon.
That's
how
great.
It was filmed. So,
you know what? That's kind of, that's another way to describe essentially exactly the process used to animate He-Man. there was rotoscoping. They just traced over real people. That's right. Basically putting a cartoon suit on them.
Yeah, yeah. It's a live-action performance.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't really have a lot of Roger Rabbit merchandise or, you know, take it outside of the movie, which is rare for me. I did end up having a Roger Rabbit lunchbox, but it was kind of short-lived in my lunch career.
Lunch career.
However.
Champion, 82 to 93.
Right. Exactly. Another excellent lunchbox I had was from a different movie that I was far more obsessed with called Willow.
To save his world. He needs a hero.
I am the greatest swordsman that ever lived.
Instead, he's got a reckless warrior. And it's all downhill from there. From George Lucas and Ron Howard.
You are great.
Willow, rated PG.
Starts Friday. Check newspapers for a theater near you.
For me, 1988 is almost defined by Willow.
We're going to park on Willow for a while, right?
Absolutely.
All right.
This was George Lucas's big return to epic fantasy after the commercial failure of Howard the Duck 2 years earlier.
Ooh.
I recently saw Howard the Duck for the first time ever, and I think the first act of that movie is unfairly hated. And the second two acts are... They're not justifiably hated, but I can see why it didn't catch on.
Right, right.
I feel like it gets a little hard to follow.
I know that I saw that as a young kid.
Yeah.
I remember being aware that it was this weird duck movie, but right. I don't have... It was visually interesting to me because I was at an age where I was just like, there's this duck talking and it's on yeah. screen. But I don't have any real memories of the movie. I just have a memory of the imagery and the concept.
Right.
Because I was probably watching it basically when it was out, which yeah. we would have been 4.
Right.
So I wasn't really aware of anything. But
that's one of the movies I remember also that Zach was always talking about. And usually if he talked about it, I went and saw it. And this was one that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
I don't know. So Willow's basically a cross between kind of Lord of the Rings meets Wizard of Oz and a little bit of Ten Commandments thrown in. It's basically about a prophecy telling of a special object, in this case, a baby with a birthmark who has the power to bring about the downfall of an evil queen.
Elora Dannon.
That's her. And Warwick Davis plays Willow, the farmer from a village of dwarves who becomes responsible for protecting the special baby.
Village of what?
Dwarves. Midgets?
Nelwyns.
Nelwyns. There it is. And he goes out into the Daikini world and meets a variety of characters and obstacles along the way, including, of course, Val Kilmer as Mad Mardigan, the greatest swordsman who ever lived. And the first of many long-haired badass characters that I would want to emulate. So I first actually saw this at my cousin Adam's house. And... I think it was probably in 1989 by the time they had the VHS.
Right.
But it's interesting that the Willow toy line, which you can almost kind of barely call them toys. They were kind of little statues. But that was the only time ever in my life as a child getting toys regularly that we were able to get a complete set of any one toy line.
It was
those.
Impressive work.
They must have been cheap because they were tiny.
And just figurines, you know, because they're non-mobile things.
Right.
Yeah, I have some things to say about Willow. I do have to say, going back to Roger Rabbit for a second.
Right.
I don't know when I first saw that movie, but I was aware of the imagery from a Viewmaster. I had a Roger Rabbit Viewmaster disc.
Sweet.
So, there you go.
That's cool.
Yeah, Willow is funny. I don't know when I first saw this one either, but I was aware of it in real time in 1988 because we had a VHS recording of a television broadcast of the movie Annie.
Oh.
And the trailer for Willow is on it, which means this was probably, you know, the VHS was probably recorded in 87.
Yeah.
You know, if the movie came out in 88. So I remember seeing the trailer for Willow and seeing the trailer for Willow many times when we would watch the Annie tape. And so that was one of the few things on this list that I really remember being aware of in real time at the time.
Nice.
Not sort of catching up on it years later. Although by the time I actually saw the movie, it was probably a couple of years.
Right. That's really cool.
I had a Willow storybook, too. It's still floating around. I think my kids have it.
Was it hardcover?
It was hardcover.
Yeah.
It's the printed story but it's illustrated with movie stills.
Right.
It's super cool.
I think I might have it somewhere, too.
And I now also have the movie novelization, which is a fun little read.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's I only read it once. I think it was in a book pile in elementary school. And it was, of course, like, oh, I know what that is. I want to read that.
It's good. It's well written. It doesn't sort of, you know, bloviate into like this huge like Lord of the Rings level or length story. Keeps it nice and short, like 60,000 words or something. But it just hints at slight little things.
There's some of the deleted stuff in there too, isn't there? Like bigger descriptions of like the later scene when they get to the castle and things like that.
Yeah, there's things like that. Yeah. There's like little tales of like Vonkar, mm-hmm. you know, like little just hints of his badassery in his past, and that, you know, he can kill a Daikini. He can go toe to toe with regular humans, and that's just pretty awesome because he's this sort of character. So it just gives you little hints of that stuff. It doesn't sort of go full tilt into any of those stories.
Right.
Just gives you little shadows. You can fill in the blanks on your own.
That's cool.
But it was really good. I only read this like last year, so like, I quite enjoyed it.
So it's fresh.
Yeah.
Nice.
I love Willow. Good choice.
Another one of my essential movies from 1988 was a little movie called Big.
No, come on.
It's yet another movie that I watched all the time as a kid. I couldn't even begin to tell you. I'd take a guess how many times. It was just constant. So basically, it's a kid named Josh who is sick of being too young and too small for everything in his life, and he makes a wish on an animatronic genie machine at a carnival to be big. And the next morning, it comes true when he wakes up as Tom Hanks. Mm-hmm. And he spends
as one does.
Yeah, well, you know, just it's that easy. He spends most of the rest of the movie living out basically every kid's fantasy idea of what being an adult would be like, including getting a job at a toy company. And then he fills his apartment with pretty much everything a kid could ever want.
Oh, yeah.
And so naturally, this appealed to me on every possible level.
Absolutely.
Do you have any specific childhood memories tied to this movie?
It's not connected to childhood memories, just memories of the movie.
Yeah.
I remember specifically being a little bit frustrated when he was so dismissive of the skyscraper transformer.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, I so wanted to play with that. I'm like, why are you putting this toy down? It looks awesome. I want to play with a giant building robot. And then there was this other toy. I remember his friend, like, it was kind of this, I don't know, there's like a bunch of segments connected all with wheels, some sort of a battle tank.
Kind of, yeah.
And he picks it up and he's, you know, sort of referring to how awesome it is. And Tom Hanks' character looks at him and goes, you know, that only cost $10 to make? Just this like moment of realism. You know,
right.
This jaded guy who's 10 years old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. I think I was just the right age where it's all of the kid-related things flooded my brain and obviously were like the kind of appeal to draw me in. But it was probably my first real experience with a more mature like story or, you know, ramifications of like real life.
Right.
Kind of seeing that. It was a good combination. It was a good gateway movie, I think, for a kid.
Yeah.
My next pick and second to last pick is a movie called Beetlejuice, which we've kind of talked about on the show before, the movie and probably more the cartoon.
Right.
But this is, as I mentioned earlier, it's a movie that I was introduced to by our mutual friend Zach, who would always quote the following line.
Nice fucking model!
So yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw this movie before I saw Pee-wee's Big Adventure, even though Pee-wee predated this by like 3 years. So Beetlejuice was my first introduction to the weird and wacky world of Tim Burton. And as a kid, I think I just kind of focused more on like the fantasy elements and not really the dark, kind of serious underlying subject matter about death and everything. Because when you watch it now, it's kind of grim for a bit.
Well, yeah.
I mean, they really don't shy away from, you know, they kind of swim in that world.
Absolutely.
You know,
I'm pretty much always okay with that because,
yeah.
I, you know, it's a tough thing and I have kids and I don't know how to really approach this with that, but I like the idea of being like comfortable with death because it's like, there's no getting around it.
Yeah.
You know, so storytelling around that element, like I never really, like I kind of embrace it and I don't know if I was thinking that much about it at the time when I would have first seen the movie.
Yeah.
But I like the dark imagery. I like Tim Burton style. I'm still sort of attracted to sort of macabre.
Yeah.
The macabre, I should say. Right. So. Yeah, this movie was, again, kind of like the other things you've mentioned, hit a lot of right notes, right combination of notes. It was so approachable from so many different levels.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that you can see as a kid, but also continue to find like an appeal as you get older.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's jokes in it now where you watch and it's like you appreciate it so much
because
of your different life experience. The movie is still just as good. I don't have to watch it with nostalgia to enjoy it.
Exactly.
It's still just as good.
Right. Yeah, and as we've discussed before, I had a bunch of the toys, and I know you had some. I still have some to this day.
They're sitting right on the shelf over there.
Right over there.
Yonder.
I feel like it's also the kind of movie that kids today likely wouldn't really get to watch en masse. I mean, maybe I'm speaking out of school here.
Well, I mean, I don't know, because you have a lot of sort of animated movies that still maintain that sort of dark style, and Tim Burton is actually a part of a lot of those movies.
Right.
You know, you've had The Nightmare Before Christmas, you've had The Corpse Bride, you've had Frank and Weenie, you've had Paranorman and Monster House. Those are all animated sort of dark movies.
That's true.
I think the dark elements come into live action movies for kids, mostly through sort of like fantasy stories now.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Not just Harry Potter and things like that, but also sort of like the second level. Like, they just had a Goosebumps movie come out a couple of years ago with Jack Black, and right. That was decently entertaining for a kid. You know, it was okay. Had some a little bit of darkness to it, and you didn't have to take it too seriously.
Yeah, that show was actually pretty dark.
Yeah, I thought the movie looked pretty good. There's actually, Jack Black's actually in another upcoming, like, sort of fantasy supernatural movie coming out called The House with the Clock in Its Walls or something to that effect.
Oh, really?
And, you know, my kids are very interested in seeing that, so I think they're out there.
Yeah. Well, speaking of animation with a dark undertone, my final pick is a movie called The Land Before Time.
The creators of An American Tale comes a timeless classic for the whole family. George Lucas and Steven Spielberg present a Don Bluth film.
I am all alone. I am.
Five friends share the world's first adventure.
You want to go with me?
Yeah!
Shark tooth!
An adventure in the land of the dinosaurs. The Land Before Time, rated G. Starts Friday at theaters everywhere.
Wow, for a cartoon, it also doesn't really shy away from the sadder, more... well, it's not just it's death, but it's also kind of reality, and it's also terror, and, I mean, there's... It kind of runs the gamut. It's Don Bluth's follow-up to An American Tale, and also another George Lucas, as well as Steven Spielberg, produced movie. I remember this being it was a big deal, kind of feature-length cartoon at the time, and it was also in regular rotation in my early life, despite how dark and intense some of it is. It's basically Bambi with dinosaurs, you know?
I didn't think of it that way, but you're not wrong.
It centers around what they call a long neck named Littlefoot taking the Bambi role, as he meets friends and tries to make it to the promised land after his mother dies early in the movie. I was mostly oblivious to kind of this more serious stuff at the time. But I remember talking about this a lot at school, and I can't remember if it was at school or like with my cousins, but I remember being with a group of kids like playing Land Before Time. Like somebody was Littlefoot and somebody was Petrie or whatever.
Absolutely.
You know,
I remember being Sharptooth. You know, you scrunch your arms up, you do the T-Rex arms thing.
Yep, there absolutely. You go. Somebody I knew also had one of the Pizza Hut hand puppets that came out for the VHS release.
Of Sharptooth?
No, I think it was... who was like the slow, like the Eeyore equivalent?
That was Spike. He was a Stegosaurus.
Yeah, it was Spike. Somebody had Spike.
Yeah, I went in there because that was connected to PARP, which was the school reading program.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was all through like Pizza Hut, you know. Yep. So you read so much, you get like points, you could take your thing to Pizza Hut and cash it in for a pizza or whatever.
Right.
And I wanted one of the Sharptooth hand puppets, but they didn't have any because everybody wanted the Sharptooth hand puppet.
Of course.
So I ended up with Littlefoot.
Okay, well, you got the star of the show.
Which actually goes to show that this is another one of the properties that I was very aware of in real time.
Right.
Not catching up on later because it was so, like, it was marketed so heavily.
Yeah.
And connected to this, like, academic experience I was having with the reading program.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I totally forgot about those. That was always, I guess. Yeah. Here, we're going to, it's government-sanctioned motivation to read using food as a prize.
I guess so.
I wonder if that contributes to my later problems. I do sure love Pizza Hut pizza.
I worked at Pizza Hut, so I like it less.
Right, naturally. My final pop culture criteria, well, it was, I'm gonna tack one more on, but I'll say my second to last pop culture criteria for 1988, It was big for me because 1988 was the year that I became a Michael Jackson fan.
All right. Okay.
I happened to see a one-hour special on CBS called Michael Jackson, The Legend Continues. It was made, it was, I mean, he was only 30 at the time.
Wow. The Legend Continues.
30. And yeah, he, it was like a little biography of his life, like a, you know, the best of kind of thing from the Jackson 5 on. But it, this was made to promote the Bad Tour, and that was only his third solo album. So yeah, it's kind of weird how early in his career it came, but they were acting like he was, I mean, I guess when you're a star from, you know, 6 or 7 years old, that you have like a full body of work.
Yep.
But it was narrated by James Earl Jones.
Wow.
And I don't know how or why I happened to see it, but from that point on, I would basically be primarily focused on Michael Jackson for the next decade until I discovered Kiss in 98.
Wow.
I'm sure you remember my fandom being kind of
your Michael Jackson fandom?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was aware of Michael Jackson, of course, but like I didn't, you know, like, I, you know, I Thriller was interesting. I know I had seen Moonwalker.
Right.
But I didn't remember. Or
that might have been 88, too.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I just, it didn't really connect with me at all. So I don't have that much nostalgia for Michael Jackson. I've grown to appreciate him more in later life.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was just was kind of oblivious to it.
So I got on the train in 88, but I didn't really, it didn't fully hit me until the next album, Dangerous, came out in 91. I don't know if we're going to discuss 91, so I'll just say that was the first like actual album I like wanted to buy. Like I begged my mom to get me this new album, and that was the first one.
Right.
So I'm just going to tack on at the end a non-cartoon TV moment. 88 was simultaneously the end of the series Magnum P.I., but the beginning of my introduction to it, like my association with it.
All right.
I remember, I think I brought it up on a previous episode. There was an episode that I remember watching with my dad. It was, it must have been, I guess it was on syndicated reruns at that time because it was in the daytime.
Right.
And I guess by then, of course, it was 8 years into its run, so it's not unusual. Yeah, so it was an episode called Infinity and Jelly Donuts, Magnum's in a Coma. And for whatever reason, that memory just stuck with me until years later. I didn't know the title, but I had to look it up later. But that was the first episode I saw, and it was also the same year Magnum ended.
Yeah, Magnum P.I., it's hard for me to say when I became aware of it because the theme song is so ingrained into my like hardware at this point.
Right.
Like I don't know when that first happened. I, you know, my parents were probably watching it like after my bedtime. Oh, so maybe yeah. I was catching the beginning of it, you know, and watching a little bit and then like, hey, it's time for bed type of thing.
Right.
But yeah, but of course then I would watch it later in the 90s. I know it would go, you know, it ran in syndication forever. Probably yeah. Still does in places. So I would watch it in the summer because they'd run like, you know, an episode of Magnum P.I. at noon and then they'd follow it up with Simon and Simon or wherever other, you know, whatever other 80s sort of adventure TV shows. But so I cannot zero in on when I became most aware of it, if it was later or if it was in real time.
Yeah.
But yeah, Magnum P.I. was a great show. So.
Indeed it was. That is my list of 1988 moments.
I've got a couple to add to the movies Alrighty. Category. I'll start with this one because it seems odd because it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that like a six-year-old would be into. But like this movie popped up so often for me as a child. And I don't know like if I had an older uncle who was always renting it and bringing it to family events or if like, you know, it was just always running on cable at my aunt and uncle's house when we'd have things. The movie is Crocodile Dundee 2.
Uh-huh.
It came out in 1988, so I probably wasn't seeing it in 1988, but I saw it so many times. Like, I don't know why that is, but it was never, like, at home. It would always just be on when we'd have, like, a family event. So I can't explain why that happened.
That's funny.
But it probably happened, like, twice or three times.
Yeah.
But two or three times when you're six or seven is, like, you know, it's a huge repetitive, you know, circumstance.
In your mind, that's the annual tradition.
Exactly. So I'm so familiar with him just whipping his rope around. So yeah, Crocodile Dundee 2. Another one is The New Adventures of Pippi Longstockings.
Ooh, yeah. I know this came out in 88. I didn't see it, but that's a good call.
We saw it a lot. And I think, again, I don't think it was 88. Because I think it might have been in another one of those VHS recordings off of a telecast.
Right.
So, but we watched it a lot. It was one of my sister's favorites. And so I have a lot of that sort of in my head. Scrubbing day is the greatest day. It's a holiday. It's as wild as you can get.
What do you think of the movie as a kid's entertainment?
I'd have to watch it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't hate it.
Yeah.
It wasn't the thing that I was picking, but, you know, I had to give her hers so I could have whatever I was picking at the time. So if I wanted to watch this other thing, then she got to watch Pippi Longstockings.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
I don't remember hating it.
Yeah.
I'd have to watch it again or at least sample it to see, like, sort of how it holds up.
Right.
I think I've seen footage of it. It sort of in just like 5 second bit bursts, just seeing like parts of a song. It kind of resembles more like a 60s Disney kids musical movie, like an Apple Dumpling Gang type of thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But again, I have to watch it.
Yeah.
And the last one I wanted to add, and it's funny because you mentioned the TV show that this character appears in, Ernest Saves Christmas.
Yay. That's 88? I thought it was 89.
Came out in 88.
Oh, no shit.
Based on my research, I'll double check it as I speak so I don't contradict myself. But it's funny because apparently that was like Ernest's high spot.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know, because Goes to Jail and Scared Stupid were both kind of like big deals relative to Ernest. I mean, you know.
It's true.
Those were the big three movies was Goes to Camp, Goes to Jail, and Scared Stupid. But Saves Christmas is right in the middle there. And I really like Ernest Saves Christmas.
Yeah, it
doesn't have
solid.
Some of the same tropes that the other ones do.
Right.
He does have a Hey Vern scene, which is one of the best ones. And he does this sort of like reptile wrangler character as they're sneaking onto a movie set. And it's just fantastic. I love it.
It's like a weird Florida.
Yeah. You know, it's like a combination of the guy from Jaws and like, you know, every sort of backwoods hillbilly you can imagine. And it's one of my favorite movie scenes.
Yeah, it's great.
And so, that's one of the ones that I still rewatch every year.
You know, that's actually, for whatever reason, I thought it had come out in 89, but I absolutely, like you said, you saw the Willow trailer. I remember the commercial for Ernest Saves Christmas being on all the time. I absolutely remember when this came out, just being very aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, because Ernest was, for a while there, Ernest was sort of
a big
pop culture thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my favorite probably was Scared Stupid, but that was kind of later in the run, but yeah.
It's funny. I think, as a kid, I remember Goes to Jail was my favorite, but the one that sort of is the most enjoyable to watch, I think, is probably Goes to Camp.
I think so, yeah.
Because it has sort of a more, I like the weirdness of the other ones, but they got really earnest-y.
Yeah.
And that one has like sort of a more general, fun summer camp movie vibe to it, just with this wacky character. It does lack the two guys in the the brothers.
Bobby and the fat guy.
Yeah, yeah. Bobby's not in this one.
Oh right.
It's this other weird guy who talks like this.
That's right, yeah.
So I don't know why that is, but he's always trying to figure out how to make eggs.
Oh yeah.
Eggs erroneous.
Oh, they're so fucking good. The show, the movies are great.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Way better than they had any right to be. Or that you would ever expect based on, you know, what they are and how they're marketed.
Right. Absolutely.
Does that bring 1988 to a close?
I was going to just bring up a page, just kind of doing it cold here, of, like, you know, pop music singles from the year and see kind of what pops up.
I know. I think overall, for the year, the number one song overall was Roll With It, Bruce Hornsby. Is that what it is?
Biggest hit singles, Phil Collins, A Groovy Kind of Love.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you have Roll With It on there?
Following songs achieved the highest chart position in the charts of 88. So, number two, Don't Worry, Be Happy by Bobby McFerrin.
Yeah, that was everywhere.
I remember very specifically. That actually does attach to my real-time nostalgia.
Yeah.
Because I remember watching the video with Chevy Chase.
Oh, yeah.
And Simon from Simon and Garfunkel. Paul Simon.
Oh no, you're thinking of Call Me Al.
God damn it. You're right.
But there is a crazy video like that for Don't Worry, Be Happy.
Fuck, so it probably doesn't match up to the year at all. Next is Always on My Mind by Pet Shop Boys. I'm just going right down the list here. Heaven is a Place on Earth by Belinda Carlisle. Take Me to Your Heart by Rick Astley.
Oh, that's also when the famous Never Gonna Give You Up came out. The Rick Roll song.
This one is specifically from the U.S. charts, so this might be a little different. Faith by George Michael.
Yep.
Need You Tonight by INXS, which I always used to read as Inks as a kid.
So did I, for years. Actually, you know what's funny?
That still is my instinct. I have to overcome it.
That's another specific real-time memory for me that you bring that up. Because I remember always looking at the Parade magazine that came with the Sunday paper. And on the back,
right.
It would always have the Columbia House record ads, you know, buy 12 for a cent or whatever.
Of course.
At the time, I was always like, I would treat it like a little, like, Where's Waldo thing to, like, hunt for the things I knew
right.
in this lineup. And then I would always look for Michael Jackson Bad. And then I would always, on my way to find that, I always saw that INXS album. I think it was Kick was the album.
Maybe.
But I always read it as Inks.
And then, so Never Gonna Give You Up is there by Rick Astley. Sweet Child of Mine by Guns N' Roses.
Oh, yeah.
So these were singles. And then there's another category here called Top Hits. So I don't know what the difference between that is, but I'm just going to go through a couple of them.
Right.
1-2-3 by Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine.
Love that.
Angel of Harlem by U2. Angel by Aerosmith. Let's see, anything else good here? Bad Medicine by Bon Jovi.
Right.
I don't really see anything else. Bring the Noise by Public Enemy, but I don't think I was listening to that in real time in 1988.
Safe to say no.
Yeah, Devil Inside by INXS. Dirty Diana by Michael Jackson.
I believe that might have been the last of the five singles from Bad.
I see. So, yeah, I'm not seeing other things that sort of pop out at me that I'm super familiar with.
There is one, I'm not sure how... It wasn't Bruce Hornsby. It was Steve Winwood, Roll With It. I believe that's from me.
Okay. I Hate Myself for Loving You, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Yeah. That's a good one.
That's, in my opinion, that's her best song.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously everybody knows the big hit, but that one's a good one.
Yeah.
I had a crush on Joan Jett for a long time.
I could see why. Badass lady.
She looked good, like, for a long time, too.
Definitely.
One by Metallica came out that year.
That's right.
Again, I wasn't listening to that in real time.
No.
I would discover that years later. I'm not seeing too much else that's popping out at me.
Right.
I mean, there's a couple other things that came out in 1988 that would become important to me much later.
Right.
You know, that Metallica album and Justice for All came out that year. Megadeth, So Far, So Good, So What came out that year.
Right.
And Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time came out in 1988 as well, which of course I would read something like 20 years later and be, you know, mind blown by it.
Of course. And actually, wasn't it just this year, 30 years later, that he died?
Yeah.
I think
it was 2000. Yeah, it was this year.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
So I guess these are all the reasons why 1988 is an essential era.